From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, Republican and Democratic governors seek to break a legislative stalemate on health care reform.
I think because it's bipartisan and because it's really sort of tweaking at the edges of what the Affordable Care Act offers to improve it, I think it may go a long way.
Later, Milwaukee Magazine shares its fall arts preview.
Regardless of what kind of experience you want, whether you want a small, intimate, say, dance performance or a big budget play at a major theater, you can find whatever you're looking for here.
Renaissance Theater Works celebrates 25 years of women making theater with its Brink New Play Festival this weekend.
And our Bubble Talk segment returns with an intoxicatingly sweet topic suggested by a listener.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. In a politically polarized environment, it was news that the Senate this week began bipartisan hearings on the future of the Affordable Care Act after the GOP-led effort to repeal and replace it failed over the summer.
But while the hearings seem like a welcome change, what are the realistic possibilities for tweaks and fixes to Obamacare? Barbara Zabawa is our health policy contributor. She's a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee and owner of the Center for Health and Wellness Law. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So we spoke a couple of times over the summer as developments in the Republican-led effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act played out. As we have heard and followed, it never happened. So as we have this conversation in early September, what is the state of things as far as the Affordable Care Act goes?
Right. So starting today, the Senate Health Committee, it's actually Help Committee, but I'll just call it Health Committee, is starting bipartisan hearings about the Affordable Care Act and what to do about it. And that, I think, is a good thing. I recently attended a talk by former Governor Tommy Thompson and former Secretary of Health and Human Services, who urged everyone to get involved because he said, if anything is going to get done with health care, it has to be bipartisan. And now is a great time that if you, as a citizen, have any input into how we can improve our health care delivery and coverage systems, to get involved now. Tell your Congress people, tell your senators what your thoughts are, because they are looking for answers. And so with the Senate Health Committee hearings and the bipartisan nature of it, because both leaders of that committee are supporting this bipartisan effort, I think that there may be some promise in actually bolstering, you know, the current status of the Affordable Care Act and trying to, stabilize the insurance markets and perhaps give states more flexibility in making sure that their markets are working.
Well, give us a primer on that. Well, why are insurance markets so shaky at the moment?
Well, primarily, I think, because of the uncertainty. Because, well, insurance generally tries to insure against uncertainty. So if the market is uncertain because government is unable to make any decisions about what the status is of the law of the land, that uncertainty fuels unstable markets and increases in premiums and uncertain future for, you know, what insurers will stay in the market, what insurers will charge in the market. And that's difficult for all players, all stakeholders in the healthcare system to contend with.
There's really uncertainty at many different levels here, not just insurers, but patients and and government as well.
And providers, yes, because they don't know who will be playing what role and to what extent. And until these questions are answered, everybody's just sort of guessing and hedging their bets.
So let's talk about as you say, the Senate is holding these bipartisan hearings, which actually it seems to everyone kind of like a nice change. Let's talk about some of the things they're considering at this point. I've read about something called cost-sharing reductions.
Right. The CSR payments, which was something that the Affordable Care Act was helping people who were at 250% or below the federal poverty rate help afford their health insurance cost-sharing responsibilities like deductibles and co-payments and things like that.
And these payments go to the insurance companies, right?
Yes, to help reduce those costs. And there's a lawsuit that the GOP brought against the Obama administration to stop those payments because there was no congressional authorization for those payments. And that lawsuit has been sort of in limbo because of the change in the administration. And so the Trump administration has been renewing the CSR payments on a month-to-month basis, but there's always this looming threat that those payments will stop. And so there's an effort by the Democratic side, certainly, and I think even some Republicans, to stabilize those payments at least for another year or two to provide some of that certainty in the marketplace.
Another issue that some say might be considered down the road is something called reinsurance funds, which I gather were part of the act in its first few years. What are they and what's at issue in terms of restoring them?
Right. So the reinsurance funds were to help insurance companies sort of have a safety net for insuring the high cost individuals that were going to be coming into the market. And
these are people with kind of rare and hard to treat diseases.
Yes, yeah. Who probably were at one point in the high risk pools and now are going to be in the, you know, general marketplace. And so there was a three R's payments that were insurance companies were supposed to get. And those payments are also under threat. So some of the, certainly the insurance industry is pushing to restore the commitment that was made originally in the Affordable Care Act to those payments. That was sort of the deal that was struck that, with the insurers, if the Affordable Care Act passes, we want to make sure that we're not going to lose out when all these new people come into the individual market. So certainly that's another. Those are other types of payments that are at risk with any sort of repeal efforts, the Affordable Care Act.
Are you hearing about any other ideas that are either on the table or maybe pie in the sky that Congress might consider?
Well, I think the strongest proposal that's out there is the proposal that was put forth last week. I think last Friday there was a letter written by John Kasich and John Hickenlooper, the governors from Ohio and Colorado, respectively, with signatures from other governors. So a bipartisan state governor effort to put forth to the leaders of Congress, including Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, and to help them understand what the states in general are thinking would be a good resolution to this stalemate with the Affordable Care Act. And their proposal is really to stabilize the market through funding of the cost-sharing reduction payments and to give states more flexibility. The Affordable Care Act does have a section in it, 1332, that gives states the opportunity to sort of innovate with waivers. These governors are asking for more of a streamlined approach in their application process for these waivers so that states can have be the testing ground for some of the things that nationally we can't do to see what works best. And so I think because it's bipartisan and because it's really sort of tweaking at the edges of what the Affordable Care Act offers to improve it, I think it may go a long way, at least with these Senate Health Committee hearings. I understand that governors will be part of the process in the next few days, and I imagine some of these governors will be part of that process.
So before we wrap up, I want to shift gears to another issue that hits close to home for a lot of people. Late last month, word came that the majority of health insurers that state employees could choose from in Wisconsin would no longer be participating in the state group health insurance program. realizing you don't have specific insight into why each of these insurers made their individual decisions, can you talk about what's going on and what you know about the situation in Wisconsin and why insurance companies would choose to participate or not participate in, you know, the opportunity to insure a very large group of people?
Yeah. Well, you're right. I don't have specific knowledge. I haven't interviewed any of the insurers that decided to pull out. But from an observer, I can see that the insurance companies that did decide to pull out of providing coverage for the state employees, which cover the whole state, these are all national or at least statewide health insurance companies. And so these companies have large groups of insureds across the country or across the state. And I know that all of these companies, or at least many of these companies, were in the running for being an administrator should the state go self-insured. That was something that Governor Walker had proposed early in the budget process as a way to save money and to make ensuring the state employees operate more efficiently. And that has not happened and will not happen. And so the insurers that would have been in a good position to be part of that self-insured administration are the ones that are pulled out of the coverage.
So they may well have been sticking around in the hopes that Wisconsin would go to the self-insured model.
Possibly. Again, it's all speculation on my part, but it means certainly those were the insurers that had the best opportunity to be part of the self-insured market.
And at the same time, a decision like this, it does not necessarily hew to the idea of economies of scale, just having access to a large patient pool as some of these companies had, does not necessarily ensure financial success. It's not, you know, the bottom line isn't we were able to cover, you know, 6,000 patients.
Right. I mean, part of the problem with health insurers or part of the struggle is to contract with providers. And many insurers in Wisconsin are provider-owned. And so you have these national insurers coming into a state where a lot of the doctors and nurses and hospitals own their own insurance companies. And so it's hard to contract with providers who are already aligned with another insurance company.
So the insurance companies have a lot of access to patients, but not necessarily access to the providers.
Right. And that can pose a problem with having a network that your patients or enrollees will find satisfactory.
Barbara Zabawa, thanks so much for helping us understand this.
You are welcome.
We'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
Barbara Zabawa is a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee, and she's the owner of the Center for Health and Wellness Law. She's also a regular Lake Effect contributor.
We'll get a fall arts preview from Milwaukee Magazine when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Despite occurring three quarters of the way into the calendar year, September marks the beginning of many things. School is one, and the start of a new art season is another.
Every year, Milwaukee Magazine dedicates much of its September issue to showcase some of the arts events that are happening this fall. Lindsay Anderson is the magazine's culture editor, and she joins me now. Hi, Lindsay. Thanks so much for being here.
It's great to be back, Bonnie. Thanks.
And we are talking about one of my favorite times of year, which is the beginning of the fall arts season. I mean, so much stuff happens beginning in late August, early September, and goes all the way through Christmas.
Right. Most of the major theater companies, dance companies, cultural organizations kickstart their 2017-2018 seasons in September and October. So it's a great time for cultural offerings in the city, for sure.
Now, you've been with the magazine now since May, so about 6 months. What kinds of things were you surprised by? You're new here, you know,
right,
and you got a chance to kind of look at it with fresh eyes.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that made you think, wow?
Well, to be honest, I was pretty surprised by the range of types of events that are available in the city. I mean, you've got major companies and museums on the one hand, but you've also got lots of interesting little storefront theaters and small music and dance organizations. So it really just feels like, regardless of what kind of experience you want, whether you want a small, intimate, say, dance performance or a big budget play at a major theater, you can find whatever you're looking for here.
Was it hard to decide what not to include?
Oh, that's a good question. We did keep in mind things we've featured in past years and tried to prioritize events or companies that people might not have seen us feature in the past or that people might not know about already. So that's sort of what our thought process was in terms of what to include. But we did also want to, you know, we wanted to make sure to include a lot of the major heavy hitters.
The big highlights. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But one of the sections that I found interesting was the section on Wisconsin artists. And you talked to Lori Winters and Deb Bramer, both of whom have been on this program many times talking about various artists or exhibitions. And there was a comment that Deb said about how Wisconsin has so many, probably more self-taught artists than just about any other state.
Yeah.
And that was a really interesting. I knew we had a great deal of self-taught artists and people who were doing really interesting things, but to kind of find out that we're kind of at the top.
Right. No, I found that really interesting, too. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the state and the region in general is so affordable. It's the kind of place where young artists can put down roots and start working. Even if they haven't had formal training, they can find the resources they need to start working as artists. I think another reason that we have so many self-taught artists specifically is that we have a somewhat industrial background and lots of people who are maybe working in factories or mills or doing something with their hands and had developed some sort of creative skill that wasn't necessarily directly related to art, but was closely related enough that they were able to find an outlet through art for that creativity.
Use it in a different way.
Yeah,
yeah. And so that was a really interesting thing. Of course, we have everything from the Museum of Wisconsin Art up in West Bend, which is not that far away, to galleries, local galleries here like Deb's and many others who are showing local artists. So I think the visual arts scene is pretty well represented.
Yeah, I'd say so. And I'd say there is a nice range of types of venues, too, from, like you said, small galleries to major museums. The Milwaukee Art Museum, of course, is, I think, one of the finest in the country. So it's great to have that here, too.
What about performing arts other than theater? We'll get to theater in a minute.
Sure.
But you also had some interesting musical things.
Right.
And, of course, there's the symphony and a lot of classical things. But then there's a lot of bands and other smaller venues who are playing indie or rap or whatever.
Right. And I guess talking about music, there are a decent number of venues. I'm a big fan of the Cactus Club in Bayview. I feel like they do a great job of presenting smaller indie acts. There's a rapper called POS who will be performing there September 11th, so coming up soon. Other bigger name musicians like the Flaming Lips, Spoon, St. Vincent will also be coming through the city as well.
And we mentioned theater, and there is almost an embarrassment of riches in this town for theater. Everything, as you said, from the very smallest, almost storefront young companies, all the way to the Milwaukee Rep, which is sort of the grandfather, grandmother of them all. And so as you were looking at the theatrical things, is there anything that stood out to you?
Well, it's hard not to think about the Rep. Their big fall show, of course, is going to be Guys and Dolls. I think it's going to be a major crowd pleaser, the kind of musical that you could take your whole family to. I'm also personally excited about Skylight's fall show. They're going to be doing Hot Mikado, which is a sort of contemporary take on Gilbert and Sullivan's 19th century classic, The Mikado. This one is a little bit more of like a swingy ragtime take on it that also sort of confronts and subverts some of the slightly racist tropes in the original that haven't aged quite as well. They kind of look at those head on and tackle them in an interesting way. So I think that show will be interesting. I'm also really excited to see the Florentines, The Merry Widow. They do a great job, and that's going to be, I think, their biggest budget fall show. It'll be a huge cast, and it should be a lot of fun to see.
Oh, it's a great piece, yeah. Too. It's so much fun. And then there's dance. I mean, we also have maybe not as many dance companies as theater companies, but we have a range of very interesting companies doing really interesting work, from the most classical
right.
to sort of the most avant-garde.
Yeah, and everything in between. One of the companies I'm really excited about is Wild Space. And I think what makes them so interesting is that they find a different location for each performance and sort of tailor the work to that location. So I think coming up this September, they're going to be performing in an old factory in River West, I believe. So the dancers will be utilizing the factory bays and kind of like leaping from like one end of the factory to the next. And it should be a very immersive experience. And I think that'll be very interesting for audiences, too.
And there's also the Milwaukee Ballet, who
right,
does
yeah.
something in the theater, but again,
right, right.
just as compelling in its own way.
Yeah. And of course, they'll be doing La Boheme. They premiered that work in 2013. It's a wordless interpretation of the classic opera. And it went over very well in 2013, so they're going to be bringing it back this year. And I think that should be a lot of fun, especially for audiences who are more interested in that more classical, traditional sort of experience.
And storytelling as
right.
well, because
yeah.
it's got a great story.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There are authors coming through. That's another. We're a very literary town
right.
as
yeah.
well. And so between Boswell Books and Books and Company and a few other places, there's a slew of wonderful nationally known authors as well as local authors.
Yeah,
coming through
absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. And there'll be the Sheboygan Children's Book Festival coming up in the fall, too, which is a great family-friendly event. Too.
Right, and it's open
right,
to people.
Yeah,
you can
free
actually
and open
go.
To anyone. Yeah.
Right. Is there anything that, as you were looking at this, surprised you to the point of thinking, I didn't think I was ever interested in that, but now I have to go?
I will say we talked about dance a little bit, but I also think dance works. Does some very interesting performances. They partner with improvisers and comedians a lot to create these sort of Mad Lib-esque kind of comedic dance performances that I've never seen anywhere else. In fact, I think one of their fall shows is actually called Mad Limbs. So it's sort of a play on that. So yeah, I would say that company was surprising in a really positive way.
Anything that you think is a must-see for everybody?
Well, the Milwaukee Art Museum's big fall show is going to feature a lot of Impressionist and Post-Impressionist French painters, from Matisse to Degas to Manet. So anyone interested in, you know, the really heavy hitters of the European art scene, I think ought to check out that fall show for sure.
Well, Lindsay, it has been such a pleasure having you in. Thanks for all the hard work and compiling, and I'm sure we will be talking with you again. And this is my chance to say welcome to Milwaukee.
Yeah, thank you. It was great being on. Thanks a lot.
Lindsay Anderson is the culture editor for Milwaukee Magazine. The Fall Arts Preview is the magazine's cover story this month, and you can find a link to it at wuwn.com.
Well, one of the season's arts events is Renaissance Theatre Works' Brink New Play Festival. It takes place this weekend, and we will learn more about it when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Renaissance Theater Works began a quarter of a century ago as a way to produce both good work and also promote women in theater, both on stage and behind the scenes. In those 25 years, the company has mounted 66 full productions and 40 staged readings. 9 of those productions were original works by Wisconsin playwrights, and 7 were world premieres. This weekend's Brink New Play Festival expands on Renaissance's commitment to nurturing and promoting work by women.
Over the course of Saturday and Sunday, the company will present stage readings of 9 new plays by Midwestern women. Madison-based playwright Gwendolyn Rice is part of the festival with her new 10-minute play, I Hear Everything. She joins us by phone. Susan Fate is one of the founding members of Renaissance Theater Works and is the director of Rice's play, as well as one of the full-length submissions, The Endurance of Light. Fate begins the conversation with some history of the festival's background.
We started Brink in 2013, and for the last, this is our 4th annual Brink Festival, we workshop 2 plays. We get submissions from female playwrights throughout the Midwest, and we choose 2 to workshop to help the playwright. It's really about whatever the playwright wants it to be, whatever the next step is for that playwright. And then we do staged readings of both of those plays during the Brink Festival. This year, because we'll sleep when we're dead, we have added Brink Briefs, which are 10-minute plays written by women playwrights throughout the Midwest. One of the things I learned from Gwen is what a great skill for a playwright to be able to write 10-minute plays, because I think what you had said to me, Gwen, was that there are so many contests that are available and so many ways throughout the country to get your name out and to get your work seen. So if you have that in your wheelhouse, so that's why we've tried to promote the 10-minute plays.
And so, Gwen, for you as a playwright, I know you've written plays of all lengths, and this is 10 minutes, the one that you've submitted to this.
Right.
And it is a delightful, delightful monologue.
Thank you.
What does that do for you as a playwright, to condense everything into that time?
Well, it's interesting, and like Susan said, it is really a very specific skill set. And it's actually most similar, I think, to writing a really great short story. And that's actually how I started writing. I mean, that was my medium for a long, long time. You know, when I was in school and out of school, I was really focused on the sort of 10 to 15 page short stories that, you know, when I teach playwriting, I talk about this concept of all the chocolate chips. You know, in a short story or a short play, you don't have time for any wasted language or any wasted moments. And so instead of giving somebody the whole cookie, you just give them the chocolate chips. You just give them the very best parts. And everything's very concentrated. And you have a lot to accomplish, you know, in that 10 minutes or 8 minutes or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you've got to introduce the character, introduce the conflict immediately, have a journey, and then hopefully have a resolution that, you know, subverts expectations ideally and gives people kind of a wow. So it's also a little bit like telling a great joke. You know, you have a very short amount of time to travel a really long ways. But at the end, if you can surprise people and make them sort of sit up and go, oh, wow, then you've done a great job.
Well, I think you do that very well in this play.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, while I don't suffer from the malady that your character does completely, I know I have a similar thing where it's very hard for me to shut out sounds. And so I immediately jumped in there. I mean, if I'm in a crowded room, it all becomes noise. And it takes all of my concentration if somebody's talking to me to focus on what they are saying and not be overwhelmed by all the ambient sound. And so I immediately was like, oh, I understand this guy right away.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
I actually was inspired to write this monologue, which is about, it focuses on a man who has this very rare condition where noise is very much amplified. So he has a really hard time just going through his normal life because everything is so, so loud. And he finds sanctuary in this library. So I was actually inspired to write the play when I had an ear infection, which I thought you only got as a kid, right? And here I am, you know, as a 40-something mom, and the pain was intense. And of course, you know, my ears were all blacked up, and I was in the shower, actually, just trying to sort of get through my day. And the way that you hear is so different, you know, when your ears are blacked and you've got this infection, whatever. And this sort of idea came to me is, I hear everything, and everything hurts. And so immediately I started thinking about that for a character. And then I did all this research to find out, you know, that there are actually people who have a medical condition like this. It's funny, actually, when the play was first performed in Iowa City at Riverside Theater, there was an audiologist in the audience.
Oh,
and he was so taken with it that he wondered if I had the condition.
Huh.
And then he asked if they could perform it at, like, their annual audiology conference.
Oh, that's so cool.
That is amazing. And did you do it?
I didn't perform it, but the actor who had done the piece, yeah, I gave them permission. I said, sir, just, you know, mention my name. And yeah, this was very fertile ground for me, just imagining the world. And I'm also sensitive to noise. So I do have a little bit of a window into this. But it was really I love this character. I love this story.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And also for you as a playwright, these kinds of performances that Renaissance Theatre Works is doing, this Brink Festival, I mean, you're a little more established now than some of the playwrights that are having their work done, but everybody's always looking for the next job. So does this help?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I love being able to add new theaters and new cities onto my resume, you know, and it's fun. I'm actually in Indiana right now because I'm having a reading of The Griot tonight. And that was the play that I worked on initially with Renaissance through the Brink. And so, my different pieces, whether they're 10 minutes or full length or whatever, they've actually taken me all over the country. And it's just fascinating, you know, particularly with 10-minute play festivals like this. A lot of times, you know, you don't get to go to rehearsal. You don't know the director. You don't know the actor ahead of time. You just kind of show up and see what your words have turned into. And you're in the audience with everybody else, and you're experiencing it for the first time, and you're sort of looking around at the other audience members and checking out, you know, did they think this was funny? Why are they laughing? You know, is everybody
did they get
attention?
The joke? Yeah.
Exactly. And the really great thing about the first time I heard this piece performed, you know, it's not exactly full of laughs. I mean, there are a couple of moments where, you know, there's maybe a couple of chuckles. But as the lights came down on this piece, I heard the entire audience gasp.
Oh.
And that was like one of the best things I've ever witnessed in a theater. It was so great. Now, this is terrific. I mean, I feel like a Brink all-star.
You know, because you are. She's also taught.
I started out, you know, as one of the first plays that they developed. And I have to say, you know, now I've had quite a few conferences and other development opportunities. And the Brink process was by far not only the most enjoyable for me as an artist, but also just the most helpful for the work. And it was extraordinary, you know, being able to spend a week in a room with all of these incredibly talented individuals who had such focus and such dedication to helping me understand the play and making it better. And then last year, I actually got the chance to teach a couple of playwriting workshops to other playwrights who were interested, you know, from Milwaukee. And that's fun because I do that in high schools. But it's not often that I get to teach adults and especially other writers. And that was the first year that you guys had added that section.
And then is that happening
yes.
this time too?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Susan, I was going to say this kind of festival and this kind of nurturing of talent and new work is exactly part of your mission statement. And it has been for what, the past 30 years?
25.
Okay.
But yeah, that's okay.
It feels
that's
like
right. it feels like 50.
I know.
Feels like forever.
Yeah. But in a good way.
In a totally good
way.
Yes.
And so are you encouraged by all of the work that you see out in the world that had its birth here?
I'm shocked and yes, and humbled and thrilled. You know, it's like anything. You just show up and you try to do your best, and then whatever happens, happens. And it's been a wonderful thing to see some of the work that we've developed through Brink go on to have other readings. And we do keep in contact with our playwrights, our past Brink playwrights. And yeah, they're all doing amazing things. As you and I have spoken about in the past, Bonnie, you know, it's still not a fair world for women in theater, in the performing arts in general. Only 20% of the plays produced in the United States are written by women. And that leads to hardships for women all through the performing arts. But that's one of the reasons we started Brink. We wanted to do it forever since we started Renaissance in 1993. But, you know, we had a lot on our plates. And so we hired a young, brilliant woman named Mallory Matoxin, who said, "I can do it." And she helped us get it off the ground in 2013.
So. Yeah, she's great.
She's fantastic.
She sat in that chair, mm-hmm. too, and we've talked about theater and about making theater. Mm-hmm. And exactly the importance of having, you know, I think people are a little more aware of the idea that not everyone's story gets to be out there, mm-hmm. and they don't get to tell their own stories,
right.
and that this is part of that. But it seems... You know, it seems like, yes, maybe 20%, but there's probably five women that get produced over and over again.
Right.
I think that's true for men, too. Mm-hmm. There's like the famous playwrights, and then mm-hmm. there's everybody else trying to do.
Sure.
But it's even worse for women and for people of color.
Yes.
It's really, really tough. And the other part of that is, how do you do this work without ghettoizing it? Mm-hmm. Because it is universal. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's story should have... We're all human.
The same chance.
The same chance. And it should speak to us or be allowed to speak to us unfettered by, oh, this is a woman's play or this is an African-American play.
Right.
It should be, this is a human play.
Absolutely.
And so I think one of the things that Brink does is it just says, hey, here's all these great playwrights.
Right.
And yes, they happen to be women, but.
Right. Absolutely. And that's what our mission is. It's very hard to say what's the best if you don't see the whole canon. And I think that's one of the things that we have always tried to do, is to choose the best plays out of all the plays, not just the plays that have been written by the same five white guys. You know, and I say that as someone who loves white guys more than anything else in the world. So, yeah.
Do you ever take some of the plays from Brink? I know it's been going for four mm-hmm. years. Do you put them in the regular season?
We have not as yet. It's something that we certainly want to do in the future. Part of it is we haven't found the perfect play yet. And also, because we only do three shows, it's finding the perfect play that would go into a particular season.
Right.
You know. So, and sometimes it's production values. You know, can we do it the way that it deserves to be done? Some of our Brink plays have very large casts that would make it, you know, difficult to do. We've often talked about doing The Griots, which is one of my absolute favorite plays. that was our very first Brink play. And, you know, that's still something that we talk about often. So
in the future.
In the future,
I was going to say, the one you're directing, besides Gwen's, looks to me, from just reading it, is a contender for that. What
absolutely.
A beautiful play that is.
It's a beautiful play. The woman that wrote it... Amanda Pettifish Schrag. She's from Iowa. And you know her as well, Gwen, correct?
Yeah, we actually have had pieces in the same 10-minute plays, both in Iowa and then at Forward. We chose a couple of her pieces to do as part of the 10-minute festivals there. So we have had our work side by side a ton of times. I don't think I've actually ever met her in person.
Oh, she's
lovely. I'm Facebook
lovely.
Friends with her. Oh, I know. Mm-hmm.
She's really funny.
And
she wrote The Endurance of Light, about a woman who is recovering from a miscarriage, and she has had multiple miscarriages, and how she decides to continue being hopeful about her life. Mm-hmm. And it's also really, really funny. It certainly is heartfelt and heartbreaking in many ways. But Sophie, the main character, has imaginary friends that pop out from underneath her bed and they're Einstein and Hildegard von Bingham and Ernest Shackleton.
Right.
So it's interesting. So
and it works together beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those wonderful things. So is this going to be a stage reading of that?
Yes.
Yeah. And so I'm looking forward to that very
Me
much.
Too. Yeah. Me so. Too. Great cast.
So, Gwen, are you going to be able to come for this?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually going to be in Milwaukee all weekend, so
Terrific.
It worked out great. And I can hardly wait, you know, to see this production of the Brinks Briefs, but also to see the audience. Part of the fun as a playwright is to watch the audience watch your play, just to see, you know, how it strikes them or if it does, mm-hmm. or reactions.
Well, I think in the case of both plays that we've talked about today, I think people will react very positively to them because they're both beautifully written.
I certainly think so, too, and we have great casts. And I think they're going to be performed very well. And it'll be interesting to see what happens.
I think it'll blow people away.
I think so, too.
Yeah. Well, Gwen and Susan, thank you both so much for joining me to talk about this. Best of luck with the festival.
Thank you, Bonnie.
And Gwen, I look forward to seeing you again and seeing some of your work again. And
thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Susan Fate is one of the co-founders of Renaissance Theater Works. She'll direct Sunday's staged reading of the full-length play, The Endurance of Light.
Madison-based playwright Gwendolyn Rice was a 2014 Brink resident playwright. She's one of this year's Brink Brief 10-minute playwrights with I Hear Everything. A complete festival schedule is available at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then it's Bubbler Talk, and we'll visit the Milwaukee factory that makes cheeseheads. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Swiss and Brie are cool with me. I love that camembert. It feels so fine, ain't life divine? When you got cheese to share, cheese, please, it satisfies my soul.
More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The cheese head has become an iconic piece of Wisconsin culture. And as we await the start of Packer season this weekend, we can expect to see a lot more of them in the coming months.
But the cheese head itself is a relatively new item in the grand scheme of things. It was created by a man named Ralph Bruno, considered the inventor of the cheese head. And he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the inspiration for the now infamous product.
So 30 years ago, what happened that you said that the world needs more cheese on their heads?
Well, it was, it'd been a slang for so many years, so definitely was time to kind of make it something more than just a slang phrase. So going to a baseball game with a bunch of friends and was reupholstering my mom's couch at the time, so I carved a piece of that foam and burnt holes with it. With a wood burner and spray painted it to make it look like all cheeses rolled up into one, and was all set to go to the game tailgating, and was with a bunch of friends, and time to go into the game. So I took the hat out of the bag and put it on my head, and my buddies kind of scattered. But as soon as a girl ran up to me and wanted to try it on, then I couldn't get the hat back from my buddies because they were having fun with the hat as well. So that's kind of how it started.
So the original hat was really couch foam. How did you come up with the new process? Because it's kind of crazy, the you know, pouring and everything.
Yeah, it wasn't anything that I knew anything about at the time. So it was just, and back in the day, it was grab the yellow pages and found that there was a local supplier for the seat cushion foam, but as a raw state, it was a liquid. So I was lucky enough to find a company that gave me a bit of the background and the chemistry and technology, and you know, sent me on my way. And just, you know, within weeks later, I was making hats.
So full disclosure, I'm from Wisconsin. I'm from a small town called Lake Geneva. And I remember when the Packers went to the Super Bowl in the 90s, you know, there's a horrendous photo somewhere of me in a cheese head with my face all painted, making, you know, the ridiculous faces
cool.
Kids make. And I feel like I'd seen the hat before then, but it seemed like that's when it kind of exploded, when I saw it, like, everywhere.
Yeah, in the mid-90s when the Packers went to the Super Bowl is when it really took off. And you know, we increased our production 600% that year. And it just was, you know, an unreal event. You know, everybody was a Packer fan. And it was the hat, the choice to go to kind of thing. And, you know, cheeseheads really united in those years, that's for sure.
So tell me a little bit about this new space. We're in Walker's Point, of course, traditionally a manufacturing area. We've seen some of that go away, some commercial investment come back into the area. What brought you here?
So there's irony here because I went to school at, back then it was Milwaukee Tech and Trade High School, so I'm familiar with the Walker's Point area through high school. But I also served an apprenticeship in pattern making next door to the foundry, Grady Foundry, which is a steel foundry here. And then on top of it all, the building that we're currently in, I used to get sent to as an apprentice to go fetch fire brick for the foundry. So that was ironic that way. But the reality of where to be, with all the small microbrewers doing tours with the Harley Davidson Museum and Summerfest, it just made sense for us to be in this area right now. We looked into Menominee Valley, another great spot, Third Ward, where a lot of people are gathering. So it's been good for us that way.
When we're talking about your facilities more generally, how many do you have in Wisconsin?
So we manufacture just in this one location here in the Walker's Point area. We had, again, moved here a little bit over a year ago. So we just have this one location.
And how many cheese heads are going to come out of this facility? This is a big question. How many are going to come out of this facility this year?
Well, and that's kind of like part of the mystique of the process and progress with us. As the story goes, when people ask how many we have made, I say it's enough to, if you start on the West Coast and put a cheese head down and start laying them the tip to the back, that it will eventually get you onto the East Coast and in the water over in New York. So, and then my son would ask me, well, how many is that? I said, well, measure a cheese head and find out, do the math on it. So, every year it's real hard to predict because, again, the popularity of the product can go from, if there's a playoff year with the Packers, that's a big deal. If we're doing a group that's going to Africa to help teach dairy over there, they may buy a bunch to go help promote dairy that way too. So it fluctuates. To me, it's not as important as making sure that, that we're expanding our market into other things. We also have, besides just the foam product line, now we're coming out with what we call non-cheese, which is everything from fabric, wearable type things. Apparel is going to be coming online this year as well. So we're adding more Cheesehead brand items besides foam Cheesehead hats.
So everything cheese related beyond cheese.
Yeah, exactly.
So when it comes to the actual foam products, when I was a kid, I remember just, the slice of cheese, that's what you were wearing on your head. Now it seems like there's a whole myriad of foam cheese apparel you can get into.
There's just about every hat, very common hat, because we're getting more into more exclusive, unique shapes and different hats. But for example, our cowboy hat is a very popular piece. This year, we've had a run on sombreros. Every year, it seems to be, the fans tend to pick a different favorite. Top hats have been quite popular. We have a hat that we're not discussing yet what it actually is. That's going to be coming out yet towards the fall part of the year. But we think it's going to be another great addition to our line. It's kind of a global. It'll fit in on a global level that people will get it all around the world. So we're excited about that new release coming up.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
No problem. Thanks for your time.
Ralph Bruno is the inventor of the cheese head and the founder of Foamation, the company that produces cheese head products. Bruno spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers at the Foamation plant in Walker's Point.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WEWM's Mayan Silver with a question from Alina Katz of Glendale.
I've heard about ice cream cocktails in Milwaukee and wondering if there's something uniquely Milwaukee about them.
Did you decide yet, honey, what you like?
I think we'll do a pink squirrel.
And?
We're going to share.
Okay, you can share now, but we're not going to have sharing in the future.
Okay.
That's pink Shirley squirrel? Zeller, taking an order from Milwaukee food writer Lori Frederick and her husband Paul. Zeller is co-owner and a waitress at the Bayview Bar called At Random. It's a place that feels a little like walking into a time warp. A dimly lit interior, twinkling lights, lounge music, Naugahyde booths, and a curmudgeon-y style. And yes, blended in ice cream drinks that, as Lori Frederick says, became popular post-World War II.
The ice cream drinks, a lot of them have been around in Wisconsin for a very long time. I mean, they became popularized, I think, by the Supper Club, where the idea was you came, you sat at the bar, you grabbed your brandy old fashioned. In the meantime, you know, you order your food, you go to your table, you eat your steak and your potatoes, and then you come back to the bar at the end and have some sort of dessert. And usually that dessert is an ice cream drink. So there's this sort of full circle that it begins and it ends with the bar.
Behind at Random's Bar, Shirley's son Randy says that customers who order ice cream drinks there have the same idea as those in a supper club.
Usually a good after-dinner drink. We get a lot of after-dinner people coming for ice cream.
As he scrapes a drink out of the blender and puts whipped cream on it, he talks about the signature butter cookie on the straw.
How many cookies do you think you've put on drinks over your lifetime?
Probably 1,000 or more at least.
That's probably underselling it.
You're probably right.
Randy's father, Ron Zeller, opened at Random after working at another classic Milwaukee cocktail bar, Bryant's. They don't put cookies on the ice cream drinks there, but Bryant's current owner, John Dye, explains what's uniquely Milwaukee about the almond-flavored, rose-colored pink squirrel that Lori and Paul ordered.
As far as we can figure, it was invented in the late 30s or early 40s by Bryant Sharp, who started Bryant's Cocktail Lounge. It coincided with the invention of the blender, and Bryant picked up the use of the blender right around then. We don't know if the cream came first and then they're like, let's use ice cream, or if, because this is Wisconsin, they started using ice cream and then for those people outside of Wisconsin, they could just use cream.
Brian came up with a pink squirrel during a cocktail competition.
And he invented three fairly famous ice cream drinks, pink squirrel, the Banshee, which is a banana-flavored ice cream drink, and then the Blue Tail Fly, which is sort of this delicious blue ice cream drink with an orange flavor.
Back at Random, Lori says these Milwaukee traditions are here to stay.
You know, ice cream and booze, most people think that's a good idea.
And Alina Katz would agree.
I think it's a fantastic idea.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in southeastern Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. Do you have a question about the Milwaukee area that you'd like us to explore? Well, if so, submit your question at wuwm.com and maybe you'll be next to quench your thirst for knowledge.
That's all for the Friday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski, Joy Powers, and Mayon Silver. We get additional reporting from Susan Benz, Rachel Morello, and Aisha Turner.
We also get web and social media support from Michelle Maternowski and studio engineering from Jason Reavy.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. It's your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Right now it's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.
Could make me be true.